Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Atlanta Press Club. My name is Ken Fosk, and I'm a reporter with the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. And I'm to remind you at this point, if you have questions for Justice Thomas, he will be taking them after his remarks. And if you could put them down on a piece of paper, and people will come around and collect them right now. One of the many interesting details that I learned in Justice Thomas's new book was the fact that in 1968, when he had decided to leave the priesthood and drop out of seminary, that he very seriously considered becoming a journalist, or a newspaper man, as he writes. Now, some of you may find this surprising, given Justice Thomas's somewhat storied relationship with the media, but the more I thought about it, the more it made perfect sense. One of the things that Justice Thomas's colleagues and schoolmates told me over and over again was their respect for his intellectual curiosity and the fact that he was never satisfied with the first answer, that he always wanted to dig deeper and find out more. One of the people I interviewed told me that he always wanted to understand why something happened, not just what happened. Sounds a lot like being a journalist. I think it's also fair to say that Justice Thomas's public life has been defined by a willingness to be skeptical about some of the big issues of his day, often at great personal cost to himself. I think this is something that we in the media can identify with, whether we're taking on a popular politician or a popular government program, that being skeptical and good at our jobs does not make us the most popular person in the room. Indeed, Justice Thomas writes in his book that as he was coming along in his professional life, he did not want to take job assignments that were coded to his race. This was something that I and others had written about with the explanation that he did not want to be seen as a token. In his book, Justice Thomas provides the additional detail that he knew if he took those jobs, that he would feel compelled to take positions that challenged the conventional wisdom. And he was simply afraid of the criticism and the attacks that would come from him. I think the last thing I'd say is that mark of a good journalist is someone who knows how to write and can tell a good story. And Justice Thomas has done that in his new book, My Grandfather's Son. This Sunday, the book will debut on the New York Times bestseller list in the number one position. So please join me in welcoming Supreme Court Justice and New York Times bestselling author, Clarence Thomas.
Ken, thank you so much. Thank you for your wonderful work, which is an apt name, Judging Thomas. Your book, I think, is an honest effort, and having written one now, I know how hard it is. But I will always refer to you as an honest man. And in this day and age, sometimes I wonder how that is all too rare. I thank you for your introduction, and I thank you for your time. I'd also like to thank my wife for being here, my partner and fellow draftsman through all of this, and she was there for every draft and all my grumpiness, spending so many hours on this. I say in the introduction and preface that you put up with me through my grumpiness that came from my protracted labors. That's a long process. But I'm pleased to be back home in Georgia. Pleased to be in Atlanta. My first trip to Atlanta, as I recount in my book, occurred 40 years ago. When I stopped here, take a plane to go to my first year of college in seminary. You're going to have to, of course, you didn't have such a beautiful airport as you have now. I think it's hard to see at that time. We also spent some time riding up and down the glass elevator at the Regency, which was brand new. And we must have looked like total pigs because we went up about 10 times. It was also the first time I had been on an airplane. My first airplane flight. I left here full of expectations and dreams about becoming a priest and possibilities of the world. There were a little bit of frustrations because I can still remember as I was at Savannah Public Library, I looked at my board scores and admission requirements at places like Georgia Tech and sort of wondered why I couldn't go there. But by and large, it was just a time full of hopes and dreams and expectations. Well, 6.5 years later, fast forward, I returned to Atlanta looking for work in one of the law firms. Well, that was a time of dashed hopes and expectations and frustration. One of the hardest times for me was wanting so badly to come back to the state. I'd only gone to law school to come back to Savannah. I didn't go to law school thinking about living in New York or living in D.C. I wanted to come back to Savannah. And some of you may remember the law firm of Hill Jones and Barron. My dream worked there. And it didn't work out. And so I started looking at law firms in Atlanta. And that didn't work out. That was enormously. To say I was frustrated is to understate. Absolutely despondent about it. But I think that it was one of those times when I got to see just how difficult it was to deal with rejection. And one of the themes I tried to weave throughout the book is that there are difficult times, there are challenges, and this was one of the big ones for me. But my grandfather had always said that you have to play the hand that you're dealt. But that's kind of easy to hear, and it's probably pretty easy to say, but it's very, very hard when you're young and impetuously trying as hard as you can to actually do that. In the end, I had to. And I think, in a strange way, that had I not been rejected in Atlanta, I certainly wouldn't be standing up here today talking to you. I would probably be safely in a law firm someplace doing the tax work that I wanted to do, and being an expert on corporate finance. Those were my interests at the time. I've written this book and to remember my grandparents, to remember the way that they taught me to live, to remember the good people of my youth in Savannah. So much is written about the South and places like Savannah that is written through sort of the prism of or the notion of what was wrong. Of course, there were lots of things wrong. I don't have to go over that. We all know that in the 40s, 50s. But there was a lot that was good. In my little neighborhood, 500 block of East 32nd Street, there was so much that was good. Out in Liberty County, family members there, out on the farm, these people were good people. There's something about them. There was no sort of vision. There was no notion that they would be doing any more than sort of the hard labor that they had been assigned to or that had been assigned. And yet, they endured, they persevered, and they stayed positive. There was something that needed to be said about them. And over the years, I had thought that my grandparents, in so many ways, were asking me, in their way, to remember them, that the people who arrived in Speck was glad, people that are gone, who are gone, saying, remember us. And my brother died 8 years ago, suddenly, just terrible. It's a brother I grew up with. In a sense, he said, remember us. And this book, in a sense, is to leave a record. So much has been written about me. So much of it is so wrong. And some of it is actually religious and so. But this is the best I could do to leave a record of those good people. What they gave us, the legacy they gave us, the hope they gave us, the vision they gave us, the positive things they gave us. I also have the hope that there's something in this book that would be hopeful or give hope to this young man who's sitting here, or someone who's going through struggles. Maybe there's something that when they're sitting there studying math, and it's hard, and they can see, it's going to be or someone who has a disability, or someone who has financial challenges, they can say, look, it is going to be okay if I keep at it. It may not look that way. I told a group, so much of the way I wrote this book was in responding, the way I responded to Q&As over the years with young students and people who come to visit me, law schools I've visited, trips I've made, and trying to show people that we suddenly didn't come from atop some mountain and descend it down to do the jobs we're doing. We came from the all same circumstances that regular people. That's where I'm from. And to show them that despite those challenges, it's worth it. It's certainly worth the effort. I tell my clerks sometimes that 5 years before I was nominated to the court, I was living in a roach-infested apartment. And they said, why? I said, well, that's the best I could do. But I think there was a chance to stop and just say, I quit, and to give up. And I'm just trying to, in the trying of this book, to provide some hope. One question I've been asked about process, and I'm trying to move along here so I can leave quite a bit of time for Q&As. But one of the questions I was asked about the process, when did I find the time to write? Because we're raising a great nephew, we're, I've got this job, this day job. Some people think that's all consuming, and to some extent it's pretty consuming, but it leaves a little room. Well, I did it at night, weekends, holidays. I don't play golf, tennis, cards. I don't hang out. I don't drink. So there's a lot of time that you can find to squeeze things in. And I don't sleep a lot of hours. So there's sometimes it's at 1 in the morning, 2 in the morning, 3. But it's just a matter of starting it and staying with it. And like so much else in my life, what I've done is simply try to keep pushing once I get started. Some people may say, get obsessed with it. I say, you just do what you have to do. As my grandfather said, it's worth doing right. Let me fast forward to the court, and hopefully your questions will illuminate a bit more, give me a chance to expand a little bit more about the portions of the book that you're interested in. I want to fast forward to the court. I have been there. I'm a few days shy of my 16th anniversary. So I've been doing this job a little while, and in contrast to the political world that you hear so much about in Washington, D.C., or the back and forth, the sort of fight, the people saying what I consider almost bombastic things about each other and the issues, the court is a wonderful respite from that kind of environment. It's like coming from a busy street and going into a very quiet library where you can think. Have you ever been in sort of a mall or someplace and you say, I can't think here, I gotta go someplace quiet so I can clear my head? The court's that place. It is a wonderful place, and we are very fortunate to have it in our society. It is civil, it's professional, it's respectful. I mean, just think about the things that we say today about each other. We don't agree. Just the words that are used, people question people's motives or their intentions or their veracity. Well, the assumption that I make and my colleagues make at the court is that we're all trying to do the best we can. And this person, my colleague, Justice Ginsburg, for example, her motives are as pure as mine. We just happen to disagree. We keep it at that level. And so we can say, in tough cases, I respectfully disagree. Respectfully, I respect your right to have a different opinion. For those of us who are judges, judging is a humbling process. It is only easy for those who have a particular side they're arguing, or they have an outcome that they want, or they don't have any authority to make any decision. For those of us who actually have to do it and to give a fair hearing and to hear all sides and make decisions, it is a humbling process. And those of us who are judges understand that we have opinions, not the gospel. That's why it's called an opinion. unfortunately, particularly in the case of those of us who happen to be considered minorities or black or particular groups, others seem to know what the gospel is for us, to know how we should come out in particular cases because of the pigment of our skins. That harkens back so often to the way things were done when I was in back in Savannah. I think that's unfortunate, but there is no gospel. There are simply opinions, and they are to be respected. I went to law school, as I said before, to come back home. I went to law school to be in Georgia, to be in Savannah, and I tried to come to Atlanta. And if anything, my desire to come home has never waned. If anything, and word that I learned from my old English literature class is that it's waxed, not waned. And it has grown, and it's something that at one point was consumed, all consumed. But now, in a sense, I am back home. My responsibilities as a member of the court put me in charge of the 11th Circuit at the court. So Georgia is actually a part of my circuit, Georgia, Alabama, and Florida. So this is the way I come home, so I'll probably be back in Atlanta quite a bit more as 11th Circuit Justice. And it is good to be back home. So with that, let me just end and begin to respond to questions, and I try to leave quite a bit of time for that.
Justice Thomas, what's the biggest misconception about you, and how would you like to correct the record?
Oh, I have no idea, because I really don't follow the misconception. I really don't follow that. I think that we have to be enormously careful that we have begun to equate things that are not much more than slurs with criticism. I think that there are constructive criticisms of approaches that we have, and I think about those, but these sorts of suggestions and misconceptions that have been created, I really don't follow them that much. One of the things, to give you an example of what I'm talking about, when I first went on the court, those who were insistent upon discrediting me suggested that I was following Justice Scalia. There was nobody more horrified by that than Justice Scalia. Everybody called up and said, "Clarence, but I never see you." And you talked me into this. I didn't talk you into it. Well, to her credit, Jan Greenberg, in going to Justice Blackmun's papers, provided written documentation that was in fact the case, that he was actually following me. But I know exactly why that's the case. I mean, just think about it logically a second. If you look at the pairing of members of the court voting together, I voted with Justice Scalia quite a bit, but not nearly as much as some of the other members that voted together, and certainly not out of proportion with members of the court who paired and voted together. Also, if you can't base it upon inside information, because the people who write it have no such inside information, and they're not there anymore. So obviously what's based on is that I'm black, and I'm supposed to think a certain way, and that there's no way, since I'm not supposed to think that I could come up with that myself, so I must be following somebody. So you make your own judgments about that line of reasoning.
Which of your fellow Supreme Court justices would you least want to argue a case in front of, and why?
I am not answering that. You got to remember, when this whole book thing is done, I had to go back to work. I just think that let's put it this way, it is not the fact that the questions would be exacting. I had about 40 appellate arguments in my early career. And I've been before some fairly exacting judges, both in trial context, tax cases, et cetera, criminal cases. But I think you need to quiet down. There's sometimes in a matter of 2 hours or over 100 questions. And I don't think we need that many questions to decide these cases. We have the briefs that are about 50 pages each. We ask specific questions to be answered. you don't allow people to roam with 10 or 12 different questions. We've been on the court. The cases they're citing, we are the ones who wrote the cases. So this isn't new to us. So I would like it if people would just let the lawyers argue and we listen a little bit more. So it would just be the interruptions that would bother me, not how hard the questions are.
Why did you choose in your book to reiterate the
Well, if I left it out, you'd be asking me the opposite.
What do you miss most about Georgia?
It's home. I truly miss home. I mean, you think about it. I don't know where you're from originally, but I'm not from North Georgia. I'm not from Atlanta. I'm from Savannah. I left here, and I was trying when I stopped in Washington, D.C. in 1979. I was trying to get home. And whether you listen to Gladys Knight's Midnight Train to Georgia, Song Simon Garfunkel's Home with Bam. You know, you listen to any of those things, you grow, as you get older, you grow melancholy, you want to go home. I don't care what anybody says, you know, it might have problems. We all went up north in the 60s thinking that it was kind of the mecca of racial relations, and we found out the hard way. And I knew the South with all its problems, with all its warts, and the South was home. I'm not from New York City. I'm not from Boston, Massachusetts. I'm not from Washington, D.C. I'm from Savannah, Georgia. And all my relatives were there, my family was there, my neighborhood was there, and I was willing to live there with all its problems. You know, it's sort of like our family members sometimes. You know, they might drive us crazy and they got issues, but you know what? They're our family. That's our blood. And in a sense, it's home. And I still feel that way about Georgia.
How is writing your autobiography different from the writing that you normally do? Did you learn anything about yourself in the process?
Learn? I don't want to write any more about me. That's hard. That's hard writing. And I think people who, you should try it sometimes. It's someone counseled me in the writing process. I was three quarters of the way and said, whatever you do, just be honest. And I'd already done that. And it is really, really hard. I mean, if you go back over your life and we look at, for example, the hardest part was having to deal with the fact that having, in my youthful way, rejected the people who did everything to make life possible. And to reject them not because of shame, that sort of thing, but to reject them because I knew so much. I wanted to be radical. I became cynical. I became negative. You know, I became this and that. And that's, I rejected the people like my grandfather. I remember going back home and arguing with him because we become radicalized in the late 60s. He said, "Why did rage you be like this?" Or he'd say that, you know, after all my sacrifice, you turn out like this, angry, mean. And then, or I'd come back and he'd say, you know, you go on up there to New England, come back with them educated fools. You know, I mean, that was probably the hardest part to write about. And then to lose them suddenly. What happens, and I think I mentioned it in the preface, is that you don't realize how fresh those wounds still are. There's a reason why we can forget things. The things you don't want to think about anymore. People who came back from World War II didn't want to talk about it anymore. They didn't want to remember. And it was very, very hard. But I don't think I'd do it again. And then after it's done, you wonder if you just talked about too much. But then my hope is, what you've done is you give fodder to the people who are going to be mean people, and you've given a basis for hope to the people who are good people.
Do you think the U.S. is ready for a woman or an African-American to be president?
Yeah, I do. There were some people who weren't ready for a black person who didn't think the way they thought I should face the Supreme Court.
Most difficult case you've heard today?
Well, let me just put some categories, because there are categories of cases that are analytically difficult. You know, people don't weep over an ERISA case, or they don't weep over a bankruptcy case unless it's their case. That's not a hard, that's analytically hard, like a hard tax case or a math problem. So that's one category. You can disassociate yourself. The cases that are hard are when your heart wants you to do one thing and the law requires you to do something else. That's a hard case, and that is when the discipline of being a judge comes in.
What surprised you most about the response to your book?
I don't know if it's, what surprised me is that it actually got through the din. I mean, this negativism stuff is just, it's so loud, it's hard to talk. I don't know if you've ever sat with people and you have a bunch of people in the house and you're trying to have a conversation. People are yelling and screaming at each other. It's like so much now we can't have a conversation about anything. We can't say anything. So getting through the din has been a surprise. And it's also been a wonderful feeling that a cab driver, we were in New York, and the gentleman who was bringing room service was so excited. He was a black gentleman, and he's just, Mr. Thomas, I've been waiting to meet you. You've been speaking for me, you know, and just I love it. And it's just there's so many people who aren't me and really do want to believe that there's a way through the difficulties of life, whatever they are. And that has been so rewarding and makes it all so worth having been done. So, but my concern always was that it would never make it through that din, and surprise it did. That people have been so good that something, giving another example of that is that the people at 60 Minutes promised that they would just simply they would show me as opposed to the template that the media has been using over the past almost two decades, that I was someone that everybody should just beat on. And for that, of course, they'll get criticized and beaten on. But that was a surprise, and it's a matter of both faith and hope that they would do the right thing, to be honest, and they were.
Does human society risk a breakdown in civility, the questioner wants to know, due to rising income inequality? What is the appropriate response of government to rising income inequality?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know whether or not one follows from the other. But I think that my view for years has been that one of the ways that, particularly for minorities in tough circumstances, to not let others' income rise faster than theirs, or too much faster than theirs, was simply being educated. You know, you got to just look at the two-parent households, no matter what color, and that had gone, graduated from high school and college, and look at the numbers for that. They're unbelievable. When you have a single-parent households that haven't graduated from high school, that's a whole different story. And years ago, 30 years ago, we were trying to make this point, of course, we were accused of blaming the victim, but we were just simply trying to make the point that my grandfather made and the people in my neighborhood made. Boy, get your education. And you don't have to be a domestic or a lawn person. You could do, as my granddad said, boy, you can do better than us. And I think that was his point, that it's going to be hard, but one way to not fall behind is to go to school and have discipline, and that's why I wrote the book. But as far as the civility, think. I just want you to think. Just pick up the paper or listen to the news and look what we've done. We've turned everything into disagreement, into a contest. If this person doesn't agree with me, this is a bad person. This person's a liar. This person has bad motives, etc. Hey, how does that advance the ball? If you were talking with a friend or a spouse, someone started out by calling you a liar or impugning your motives, would you be able to do something constructive? Would you move advance the ball? Is the issue in any way resolved? The answer is no. We know that. So ourselves, but we've become very, very comfortable. Of course, in my case, anything can be said is automatically true. Well, I don't see how that helps anybody, you know, and I found that fascinating. But I don't know if the civility and the income differences are really connected to one another in that way. I understand the point, and all of us should be concerned, but huge parts of our society are left behind. I don't think it's good for society, and I don't know how long this society can survive in that way.
This question wants to know more about your job search in the Atlanta area. What are your feelings and recollections about your search for a legal job in the Atlanta area? Do I understand correctly that you ultimately received a job offer here? How did going toward the Missouri Attorney General affect the overall trajectory?
Well, I don't want to say anything negative, but they'll ask you to recuse. But that's another silly thing. But, I don't think I ever got a job offer. I was sort of moved along, and there were efforts to keep trying. One of the people who continued to try and work hard for me was Lawrence Ash, local attorney, and I've always been indebted to him for that. But no, I took a job in Jefferson City, Missouri at the last minute and with a very, very good man. The hardest part of taking a job in Jeff City was that he was a Republican. And I had never voted Republican and didn't know any Republicans, and I wasn't planning on working for a Republican. And I went out to Jeff City to work for Jack Danforth and asked him, as I know in the book, that he treated me the same way he treated everybody else, no better, no worse. He did that. So it turned out, again, to be fortuitous, if not providential, that I worked for just a good man who's honest. And so I tell my clerks today to work for the person, not the job. That you work for a person of character, it'll work out. He was a wonderful, wonderful man of character. So, but I don't recall ever receiving anything but rejections from the large firm.
How do you handle making decisions that conflict with your morals but agree with popular opinion?
My job is to decide legal cases and constitutional cases. I think that I have taken an oath to decide cases impartially, and that does not include my personal opinion. My personal opinions are mine, not something I can inflict on your constitution or on your laws. What I try to do is, in a very practical way and an overarching way also, is to put a firewall between my personal opinions and your constitution and your statutory law. And in my 16 years, I have never put my, imposed my opinion on any of those, my personal opinion.
As someone who's benefited from affirmative action, what accounts for your opposition to affirmative action?
Well, first of all, there was no such thing called affirmative action when I went to school. I love it when people say that. And that's a longer story that I deal with in my book. And I'll just pretty much leave it there. But the assumption was that let me put it this way, the only place where people say that I was accepted based on race, it was not Holy Cross or any other school, certainly wasn't St. John, was Yale. Well, I couldn't get a job out of Yale, so much for that. That entire experience was discounted, everything I did at Yale. So the next period that really made for the rest of my career was actually the Attorney General's office in Jefferson City. And it was, I didn't receive job offers in Jefferson City until after I had proven how well I could do in court. I had argued 40-some cases, argued briefs, written briefs, written opinions, etc. It was only after that that I received job offers. So there's a huge disconnect in my life when people say, well, you benefited from this, why are you against it? So I think what they need to really... I wish they would look at the fact how quickly all my achievements were quickly discounted and wrapped in something. But one of the arguments that's made when I was nominated to court was that I wasn't qualified simply because I had benefited from these programs. That was the argument then. So I don't think you can have it both ways and say that everything that's good has happened because of this, and I'm not qualified because of the very same thing. Nor can you look at the fact that I couldn't get a job out of this law school and say that it's the cause of everything else that's happened in my life. And yet, that same law school that wasn't the basis of employment turned out to be the basis for the entire subsequent career. None of this makes any sense. My problem with it is that I think that you help people. I've helped all sorts of people. Who do you want to help? Now, let's just take these kids that you're talking about, the income differences, for example. I've worked with kids. These kids are in dysfunctional situations. We can argue in theory way up here, and we can disagree. But in the end, I think that going in and actually affirmatively acting to help specific kids is far, far more important. And put them in a position so that we can have the luxury of arguing about what a policy should apply for graduate school. Because most of these kids now, if you look at the huge dropout rates in middle school, high school, etc., none of those kids are touched by any of those sorts of things. And I think we should spend more of our energy actually working with those kids rather than arguing with each other about which approach is best.
There is a book called Divided Soul, a biography written about you. Can you please share why you chose not to speak with the authors?
I have no idea. I've never heard of that book. But I didn't want to speak to him. If that was those two guys. I really don't spend a lot. I know who I am. I don't need to speak to people writing now.
Do you see any potential conflict of interest with your book events?
Again, what sense? This isn't, you know, other members of the board that have book events. I don't see the problem.
When you joined the court, did you wonder why justices don't retire until their health forces them to quit? And what's your perspective on that now?
Well, I don't know whether that's an argument worth having. Some people think it's important, you know, with term limits for court members, etc. What I found when I showed up, when I thought that Justice Black, for example, he was 40 years older than I was. And I just figured, I said, well, there's no, you know, I could do this, you know, I'm full of energy, et cetera. And he's 83 years old. Well, at the end of the term, I was dragging, and he was cruising along. He seemed to have no problem. So I think it depends on the member of the court. Justice Stevens is 86 years old, but just a brilliant, sharp man. Other than the fact that you might disagree with him, why would you want him off the court? He's got all the experience, and what happens is that over time, you get this sort of experience with all these legal doctrines in such a way that you're able to see nuances about the law that you're not able to see in your first few years. I will recount this one little story, though, that when I first got on the court, Chief Justice Rehnquist and a few of us were having lunch, as we normally did, the members of the court. I told him, I said, Chief, you know, I wonder, you know, I'm here, and you all have been here a long time. Justice O'Connor, the first woman on the court, you've been here as long as anybody. Justice White is a legend. And I said, I wonder why I'm here. And he says, well, Clarence, in your first 5 years, you wonder how you got here. After that, you wonder how your colleagues got here. So I'm not at that point, but I'm also not at the point of saying that because as long as they can do the job, they should resign before they're ready to.
The question says, many professionals do not report harassment at work because they fear reprisals, such as loss of opportunity, jobs, or alienation from peers. How would you recommend professionals in this circumstance report harassment?
Well, I think what we have said in some of our cases is that now it is an affirmative defense for companies to have processes to deal with it. And certainly, the government had that the whole time. I was an executive in the government. So I think that's kind of a lame excuse now.
What's strangest experience you've had when you and your wife have parked your motorhome at Walmart? Is that something you know?
We do have a motorhome, in Texas, a motor coach, and I've been to Atlanta. Boy, that man drives too fast. There's a lot going on around Atlanta on the interstates. The strangest experience actually I had is after Bush v. Gore. It was one of them. She wasn't with me. But you know, Bush v. Gore was a little bit controversial. And I was actually taking my coach down to Florida. That's one of the things. When you have a motorhome, you have to service the line. So don't get into this thing. It's going to be an expense-free adventure. It's like a boat. It's just something for all the money you have. But it's been priceless to me. Well, I was in Brunswick at one of the truck stops because of diesel. And again, it's right after Bush v. Gore, a trucker comes up and he says, anybody ever tell you look like Clarence Thomas? And I just said, yes. He said, I bet it happens all the time. And that was it. He walked off. I've had it once I got out, I was fueling at the truck stop. These are the things you put 150 gallons in or something. Oh, gosh. Anyway, you can do it. I'm acting all professional like the truckers. And this black gentleman who was driving one of those big diesel trucks next to me, he comes up and says, talks to me, and he says, anybody famous on that coach? He wouldn't let it go. He comes back. I think he may have seen my wife in there or something. He comes, you sure there's anybody in there I need to know? So it has been one of the... Oh, yeah. We had a mouse on the bus. Oh, yeah, but my wife, there was a mouse on, well, she said there was a mouse on the bus. There was evidence of a small critter on the bus that we never saw, and I told her not to scream because I didn't want to wreck my coach. But we have had some of the most delightful times when people didn't recognize us, and we are just like everybody else, walking to Walmart, a supercenter early in the morning, going around the lot. And one of the reasons we got it is because someone told us that some of the best people in the country are in the RV park. And it has been a delight.
The pay gap for women is about 77 cents on the dollar. As an authority on equal opportunity in the workplace, where do you think responsibility for this gap lies? And how can individual women be more proactive in closing the gap?
You know, I haven't followed that data, and I don't know if that data is. I hire a lot of female law clerks, and their starting salary at the firm is about $400,000 a year. And I think there's any gap, it's the only gap between their income and mine. But the point is that I really don't know, and I would be remiss if I waded into that because I don't know if the premise is accurate.
Today, less than 3% of the Fortune 500 have women as CEOs. Are we likely to see a woman as Chief Justice in your lifetime?
That's a very good question. One year I walked into my chambers and I had four female law clerks there. And I asked them, how did that happen? And they said, because you don't have any false criteria. I just hired the best. And that year, four women, one was leaving, but the other three were staying for that year, were the best. It's that simple. And I think that I am not a believer that that women are unqualified to run companies, or unqualified to be president, or unqualified to be law clerks or chief justice. I think that if we stop discriminating and stop with these sort of false criteria, that lots of people would be in positions where they could achieve. I feel very strongly about that. My lead law clerk happens to be a black female. Well, I didn't go out to hire a black female as my lead law clerk. I just simply hired the best law clerk, and this was the one who was best suited to be lead law clerk. I can't tell you that a woman will be Chief Justice in my lifetime, simply because the Chief Justice is younger than me. But I can tell you that I foresee when the majority of the court can easily be women. There are tons of outstanding women judges. I'll ask you this question rhetorically. Did you ever think you'd live long enough to see a black female Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of the state of Georgia? Did you ever think you'd live that long? And when Leah Sears became Chief Justice, I made it a point to be here. It is absolutely historic. Now, if that can happen in the sovereign state of Georgia, I think it can happen over the entire United States, and it can happen with respect to the presidency. So I don't think, if you'd asked 15, 20, 30 years ago if that could happen in Georgia, most people would probably say, not in our lifetime. I think it can happen. I have to believe it will happen at some point. And I think we all want to believe it can happen. But in any case, I want to thank you all for your courtesy. I'm pleased to be back in Georgia. I'm grateful that you all had me here today and wonderfully grateful that you all bothered to come out. So thank you very, very much.
The Atlanta Press Club would like to show our appreciation by making a donation to your favorite charities, and Stanford University is a gift for you as well. Everyone, we hope to see you again in our next Newsmaker Luncheon with Dr. Julie Gerbig from the UC on November 24th, Governor Sonny Perdue on November 5th.